the quality and depth of the academic programs that are available to the students on the key campuses by having courses that are developed and delivered on one campus available to students at other campuses. We've also begun to work on collaborative work between the campuses. The major effort so far has been in teacher education. We had a meeting last October with faculty members from the three education programs in the university, and this was in partial response to requests that I have gotten from the superintendents of schools in the state. I formed this meeting. We now have groups working in three particular areas to be responsive to superintendents' needs. One is the area of educational administration program to train principals and superintendents. Second is an area in special education, which has become a major need throughout the state. We have one very strong program of special education in Anchorage. How can you, Anchorage, share those resources around the state so that we don't have to duplicate their program, yet make it readily available? And the third is in the area of instructional technology, where the frontier work is being done here at UAS. Here again, how do we move that program so that it's available to teachers around the state, future teachers as well as present teachers, without having to duplicate that program on the other campuses? We're also looking at a number of changes in the student service area. We're looking to develop a single admission application. Right now you have young people that arrive at, or older people, who arrive at UAA or UAF, and they get an application form. They're really filling in an application for a different campus. And it becomes a little difficult for people to hand that application back and say you have to get another form. So we're trying to get a single admission application form to be used around the system as a way of being responsive to the public and welcoming the public. Second, we're developing a single transcript. And students that are at any one of the campuses but has taken courses at other campuses or have had courses transferred in from universities outside of Alaska, or the private institutions in Alaska, will all be on this particular transcript. It is, again, an opportunity to serve students better. We're trying to develop a system of cross-campus registration so that students will be able to register for a couple courses on one campus and perhaps some courses through distance education. Right now, a student that registers for two or three courses at one of our campuses but wants to take a couple other courses through distance education has difficulty getting support. Student aid support is a full-time student because they look like two half-time students and their two parts are never added together. A single registration process would not only handle that issue but handle a number as well. We are still in the process of minimizing transfer problems. I think we have gotten rid of most of them in the system. There are still some around, and we're going to do whatever we can to erase transfer issues. And we're looking forward to a coordinated student aid program or student aid advisement program. That may be the most difficult of these student service items to pull off, but it is one clearly that's worth doing. When our budget was initially prepared and submitted by the administration to the Board of Regents and by the Board of Regents to the governor, oil was at a higher price. And we once again listed the needs of the university under five areas. We looked at maintaining existing programs, at building and equipment maintenance, renewal and replacement. A third was improving campus security. That was a new item in the budget. Fourth was improving instructional delivery and student services. And the fifth was research. In maintaining existing programs, what we were asking for was the funds necessary to maintain what we were doing given the increased costs of doing the same amount of work. In building equipment maintenance, renewal, and replacement, you've long known that as a feature or need of the university to have enough funding to maintain its buildings, to maintain where it is right now in terms of its instructional and research equipment. Clearly, we need to renew much of the equipment that we have, and we need to maintain the facilities that we have. This goes beyond the deferred maintenance problem, which you've also heard a lot about. Improving campus security. Campuses, like every other area in our society, has become crime-ridden. And we have had to invest more in protecting our students and in protecting the entire facilities. It is one of the expenditures that no institution likes to make, but it is an expenditure that universities all across the country have had to increase and we were asking for funding to improve campus security. We have been in the process of doing that over the last year or two, but we need some help. We then went to improving instructional delivery and student success, and there primarily a major portion of that was to get more full-time faculty for the Anchorage campus. In the research area, looking for support both in personnel but in equipment as well. There are a number of research opportunities available to the University of Alaska, research that would clearly be reflected in benefits to the economic vitality of the state that the university should be involved in, and we were seeking funding for that. To meet the current year's budget, we have had to go through a certain amount of internal stress, though we were fortunate enough last year to have $5 million added to the budget. The $5 million did not allow us to fully cover the inflationary pressures that were on the university. We have been taken a number of steps in order to ease the financial stress. One has been, for the first time in the history of the university, we are sharing healthcare costs with our employees. Not something that was easily accomplished, but something that is now in place. We have had an enormous number of reallocations on the campuses, moving money from one area to another, from one program to another, in order to make ends meet. With all of that, we have still had to take an erosion in the real value of the base budget. We have not replaced all the equipment that should be replaced. We have not maintained the buildings to the level they should be maintained. Our library acquisitions are not as great as they should be, and we have not made the necessary improvements in telecommunications that modern universities need. We continue to need your support in our pursuit to help educate the population of the state, to work in the economic development of the state, and to assist in the strength of Alaska's culture. There are some items outside of the budget that we are working on, two major pieces of legislation. One is bonding for deferred maintenance needs of the university, and the second is our pursuit of a larger land grant so that eventually the university will be able to earn through its land and its own activities a larger proportion of the budget that's necessary to operate it. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm available for any questions that you or the members of the committee might have.
Are there questions from the committee? I wanted to focus in a kind of a macro sense on the university's budget, not just the general funds portion, but the total funds, to get a feel for how the university's situation is looking. Perhaps you want to have Brian help you with. I wouldn't expect you to.
I have it all memorized.
But what I'm looking at is the increases. You know, there's no increase in general fund or general fund match, but there are substantial increases in federal funds, and I assume university receipts and those other ones. If perhaps Brian, if you could walk down the funding sources and talk about the areas where there are increases. So that we can get a feel for where the increases are coming from in your funding sources.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The largest single increase, there are two, both related to Fairbanks organized research areas. The total non-general fund increase is nearly $34 million as requested in the budget. Some of that is related to other increments that, for example, a new faculty increment will generate certain student fees, but there are some that are independent of your approval of the general fund. The largest is in the federal authority and interagency receipt authority in the UAF organized research. What we've seen in the last 5 years is a doubling in total research activity at the university. And this year, for the first time, a very significant increase at the University of Alaska Anchorage, with two major grants, both related to the American Russian Center, bringing in nearly $4 million in federal funds. And so, what we are asking for in the in the non-general fund authority first will be those federal funds. Other significant increases, tuition. We have increased tuition receipts from really two sources. One is the increase in the number of students generates a corresponding, as we teach more classes to those students, it generates additional tuition revenues. Second, we have scheduled a tuition increase for the fall of 94. The board will be voting on that at the February meeting. If the board takes no action at the February meeting, it's indexed to the higher education price index, which would be an increase from $64 to $67 per credit hour. We have...
Brian, is that under university receipts?
That's under student fees. It's funding source 1038 is student fees.
Uh-huh. All right.
Let's see, maybe I'll run through them in order. General fund match, general fund, general fund mental health, not going up. IA receipts, principal increase there is again Fairbanks campus, some for School of Fisheries. Some of that is within the university, chargebacks, etc. Some of that is external funds, primarily from state agencies, for research, some of that associated with the Exxon Valdez oil spill and the Exxon settlement money, probably the biggest single increase there. Interest income, no increase.
Would that be the single biggest element within that total as well as the single biggest element of the increase, the Exxon Valdez?
It would not, no, by no means would it be the single largest item within the IA. Most of the IA is what we call intra-agency, that is, receipts within the university, where a department buys supplies from another department, and that shows up...
Within the university itself.
Within the university itself is the largest component. The 1050...
So it's basically, if you were to look at your total agency funding of 426, that... You might take out a substantial portion of that as double counting.
Yes, maybe Allison would have a guesstimate as to what the total of the IA receipt is within the university.
It's my understanding, Brian, at all, is that the other monies are accounted for in the university.
Oh, okay, so it's all within the. I'm sorry, I thought we were accounting for some of that.
Okay, that's all internal funds, and
yes.
Then the
so
external
that really
funds
is
are down below.
Correct.
In the university. Okay.
The 1015 is dormitory food and auxiliary services. That would be rents in the dormitories. That would be the food service. That would be the bookstores and parking receipts. 1015.
1015. Okay.
About $400,000 increase this year.
And that was again. That was a bookstore. You say
bookstores, dormitories, and food service.
Okay.
And all of those are operated basically as enterprise-type funds, attempting to operate on a long-term break-even basis.
Okay.
Indirect cost recovery is the proportion of overhead costs paid on federal grants and contracts primarily. As federal contracts go up, the indirect cost proportion that the federal government pays for goes up correspondingly.
Excuse me, what line is that, or code are you referring
1039.
To? That's indirect cost recovery. Okay. I'm
correct.
Okay.
Okay, refresh our memory on the science and tech. We're taking...
Funding $3 million for the... there was a swap for general funds 2 years ago in the budget for...
we just held that constant.
Yes, we have not asked for an increase in it. The Science Technology Foundation Board would like us to ask you to replace it with general funds. Please consider this that request.
Okay.
University receipts would be our, that is basically all other receipts of the university. That would be anything from sales of goods and services by university departments, miscellaneous charges. It would be all of the grant and contract activity with state agencies, with corporations. It would include money received from endowment income, land grant income, and
it looks like a large increase occurred in between FY 93 and FY 94. about 17 million or so. Would that have been increases from the Exxon Valdez?
I don't have 94's budget with me, the request with me to look at what the components of that are. I'd be happy to report back to the committee.
We generally, of course, tend to focus on the federal fund, or the general funds, but you've got a lot of other funds, and I think it's important for us to understand how they all relate to your ability to do your job.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman, and that really reflects the ongoing effort of the board and the administration over the last 5 years to decrease our reliance on state funding. When I came to the university in 1984, 74% of our appropriation was general fund. We're now below 50% general fund, and it has been through the express wishes of the finance committees as well as our own need to keep going that we have actively focused on developing other sources of revenues to cover as much of our program as we can.
Senator Rieger.
If I can elaborate on that, because we had some lengthy discussions on this in the subcommittee or at the subcommittee level last year. That was, I think, a renewed or a re-emphasized direction that Senate Finance generally gave to the university, was that if the university was to survive and grow, they had to look outside for more grant money, research receipts, and non-general fund type of receipts. And this was a dramatically different direction than House Finance was going and the direction that they gave. And there, I think there was a little bit of push and pull as to what the emphasis of the university should be on. But I still strongly feel that if the university is going to survive, they have to allow the types of activities at the university that bring in research and grant dollars to go forward. And that, in general, means an emphasis on upper division courses. And it doesn't mean to sacrifice the other missions of the university, but that effort is what brings in extra money that keeps this university healthy. And I really will intend to reemphasize that in our deliberations this year and to keep those kinds of growth patterns going. But it was, something that really, I think, was a little bit of difference in point of view, and I don't know if you care, you probably don't want to elaborate on that, but it's something that did come up last year. And, and I had a particular hearing on it, I think, I can't remember, I think I was the only one there, but we just talked about where the money comes from. And it's true, of all of the campuses of the university. It's not just Anchorage and Fairbanks that are really eligible to bring in grant money. I think there's other places where that kind of money can come also.
Mr. Chairman, I think what you see is that the focus of the increased general funds we've been receiving is on the instruction and, to some extent, physical plant areas. If we're going to grow in other areas, it's clear to us that it has to come from other sources. And some of the initiatives we've tried in order to try to increase our income have multiple effects, both in may have some general fund savings, may have some differences in quality. And an example of that might be our video conference initiative this year. The university has gone out and purchased video conference equipment to link the Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau campuses. That's having several effects. One is to reduce the amount of administrative travel. We're finding that more of our system meetings can be held by video conference and save pay for the video conference by the travel savings, and also reduce the amount of time that's spent. Instead of losing a whole day to a three-hour meeting, we lose 3 hours to a three-hour meeting. Second, it allows us to extend instruction to multiple campuses. And third, with our cooperation with the state, we expect some state agency use, which will help pay for that equipment and provide ancillary benefits to the state as well. Those are the kinds of things we're doing. We are further opening up our computer network to state agency and school district use and are getting quite a lot of school teachers onto it. That also helps amortize the costs of our computer network. It does bring in some revenue to the university, but it also provides a better benefit, we think, to the people of the state.
I would note there on your travel line item up on the top half of that page that you've got a substantial increase in travel over last year. And over the FY93 actual numbers. You must have a good explanation for that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I do, and that is that the governor's budget approved every increment we requested and then approved a $27 million decrement, which is contained in the miscellaneous line item. And so what you would see would be the reallocation of that $27 million across will have some very substantial impacts on the rest of the numbers. In addition, particularly in the research area, there is a definite increase in travel budget in that area. The American-Russian Center alone, substantial portions of its $4 million budget are involved in travel, both within the United States and within Russia. And so you can expect the travel budget that is funded by non-state money to grow. You can expect the travel budget that's funded by the state to decrease.
Okay. Other questions? Anything else that you gentlemen would like to talk about at this level?
Perhaps just briefly, I could mention that we do have a capital budget request as well. I'm not sure if you're taking
testimony. Well, we're going to have a separate hearing on the capital budget, but it wouldn't hurt to go over it because I'm not sure exactly. Senator Pierce will handle that. Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman, again, this budget was prepared back in September when things were a lot rosier than they are today, but we do have capital needs that we do need to address. The capital budget for the university is really in three parts this year, one part being our work with the governor's office on trying to comprehensively address the issue of deferred maintenance, and we would expect legislation to be forthcoming on that. The capital budget that you see in the Red Book does not include the deferred maintenance because we have been working with the governor's office on dealing with that separately. In addition, our ADA compliance projects are not contained within our capital budget because we're working with the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities and OMB on following their methodology, and whatever the governor requests for ADA compliance, using the ranking system, certain of our projects are likely to come out in their process. Our budget focuses on several areas. We have a small amount of code compliance remaining at UAF. We have a series of requests in campus safety and security, which really match the operating budget areas where we're trying to reduce our exposure to further litigation or better protect our students, faculty, and staff. The equipment area is a very substantial request and is moving up on our priority list. We're finding that we don't have enough funding in the operating budget to address the instructional needs, and those are growing, and as technology changes more and more rapidly, we need to keep up with that technology so we're teaching students who can emerge ready to work, ready for the workforce. That's probably the next big capital area that we would focus on after deferred maintenance is dealing with some of those equipment issues. We have a series of building completions and remodeling projects. The natural sciences facility will be ready to open if it gets its final appropriation this year. In fact, the contractor is ahead of schedule, and we may be able to open a semester early if we do get that appropriation. We have a federal matching project in the aviation technology building at UAA. Series of other smaller completion projects or remodeling projects other building completions. At the same time, we are growing in terms of number of students and in terms of the other activities, and have certain needs for new construction or planning for future new construction. We recognize the financial realities the state's facing, and we'll need to we're well aware we'll need to look at creative ways of dealing on the capital side. On the operating side, at the governor's level, we'll need to find $5 to $7 million internally to keep up with the inflationary impacts on our budget, and we expect a fair bit of work and discussion within the university to deal with those. Chairman, those are the main remarks. Again, if there are any questions, we'd be glad to answer them.
Are there any questions?
Could I just a couple points? One is an invitation that the Board of Regents will be meeting here on February 17th and 18th, and I hope that you will be able to come to any part of that meeting. There are going to be some interesting sections, particularly discussion on organization, and an organizational change will take place on the morning of the 17th. But one of the best ways, I think, of looking at the budget proposal of the university and the activities of the university is in terms of what the university expects to be like 5 or 10 years from now. And one of the, if you look over the demographics of the state, we're going to be under much greater demand for providing education at almost every level. We're attempting to work out some programs now with the with K through 12, particularly the high schools, on tech prep programs where students will be prepared for the labor force by combining activities and educational opportunities in the last two senior years along with the first 2 years in college. The need and the expectation of having more baccalaureate students clearly it is going to be there, particularly in the Anchorage area. The research opportunities facing the university are really enormous, and I went over them, or I just mentioned that before. But if you look over what needs to be done in order to protect the fishing industry of the state, if you look over the potential that we have in terms of energy, energy source, and energy use, you recognize that this is just ripe for investment, and in fact, it would be avoiding a major responsibility of the university if we did not put resources into that. But the whole question of technology transfer, what role should the university be playing in order to bring technology that's transferred, that's developed either in our laboratories or laboratories around the world to the economy of Alaska, to the business people of Alaska, to the people of Alaska. And that is an area where we have just gotten some major federal funding. It's a combined program from the Small Business Development Center here at Anchorage, along with the Science and Technology Foundation. It's an area that we're going to take really an active role in the future. The university as a center for society. There was a wonderful quote by one of the leaders. I'm trying to recall if it was one of the former presidents of Harvard who was referring to the university as being a central institution for the 21st century, not only in the American society, but in every industrial society. One of the statements that came after that was that it always was. I'm not really sure if universities always were a central institution for society, but clearly when you look at the 21st century, that's a role that universities are going to have to play. We're looking internally to be able to scratch every resource possible to meet the future demands on the university, which are growing. And what we need your help for, and really where you've come through in the past, is by helping us work on that equation with some additional funds and some additional legislative help. So thank you very much for this opportunity. Look forward to talking to you again.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much, and look forward to working. Okay. Is there anything else come before the committee? Any comments? Okay. If not, we'll adjourn. Senators Frank, Pierce, Sharp, Kratula, and Rieger. Today we're going to cover health and social services, transportation, and law. So we'll start with health and social services. Commissioner.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'd like to give you a summary of where we think our new budget is at. All of our division directors are here if there are questions or concerns be available. Department of Health and Social Services FY95 general fund budget request is $468.5 million, an increase of 7.9% over FY94. While the continuing increase in health and social services programs is dominated by the growth in formula programs, it is clear that most of our programs are client-driven, and the 49% growth in Alaska's population from 1980 to 1993 impacts all services within our department. The formula programs, especially aid to families with dependent children, adult public assistance, Medicaid, and foster care and subsidized adoptions grew by 15% between FY94 and 95, while direct service programs in mental health, public health, alcohol and drug abuse, and family and youth services had zero growth. Despite department and legislative efforts for cost containment of the formula entitlement programs, caseload growth, price increase, and increased utilization of medical services continue to drive costs up. In FY90, formula programs comprised 46% of the department's general fund budget. In FY95, formula programs make up 57% of our general fund budget. Department of Health and Social Services has requested an increment of $6.2 million general fund for the public assistance formula programs, AFDC, and adult public assistance, an increase of 6.3% from FY 94 to 95. This increase is based on projected caseload increase of approximately 9%. Between FY 90 and 94, the AFDC caseload growth ranged from 12 to 20%. FY95 is the first time in 5 years that we have less than double-digit rate of growth. While the budget has grown because of population, the administration chose not to include any increase for an FY95 COLA. The budget also factored in the reduction in welfare benefits enacted in FY94. The ratable reduction passed last session is projected to save $45 million over the 3-year period from FY94 to FY96. Although these actions reduced the client's grant amount, it did not eliminate any administrative responsibility. Eligibility technicians still have to process the same number of new applications and manage the same caseload as before the grant reductions. This committee has heard about this issue before, and we understand that money is very tight. But we also feel compelled to bring this issue to your attention because of the long-range implications it has on the public assistance budget. The $26 million general fund increase in medical assistance formula programs, Medicaid, General Relief Medical, and waiver services, is caused by caseload, medical consumer price index, and program utilization increases totaling $19.7 million or 15.3%. The other $6.2 million GF increase is due to implementing the second year of the Medicaid waiver program, Project Choice. Family and Youth Services formula programs, foster care, and subsidized adoptions have requested a $2 million increase due to a proposed rate increase in the base rate paid to foster parents. The rate has not been increased since FY91. The department has also projected a 37% increase in the number of subsidized adoptions between FY93 and 94, from 450 cases to 617, with a corresponding decrease in foster care of 8%. Permanently placing children in stable adoptive settings has been a long-term goal of the department, and you can see that we have made progress. We understand why the finance committees want to focus on the formula programs within the Department of Health and Social Services as we look to reducing state spending. I would just remind you that reductions in this area, while possible, are complex and need considerable discussion. The Medicaid option list, as outlined in statute, is available to the legislature to make changes or eliminate specific Medicaid services. This is a significant tool at your disposal. Specific changes to the non-formula portion of our budget are more numerous.
Could you repeat that one time more? Thank you.
That's okay.
On the Medicaid option list?
Yes, yes.
Medicaid option list, as in statute, is available to the legislature to make changes or eliminate specific Medicaid services.
Can we digress on that for a second? Does the administration does have also authority to move up the list, eliminating services as well? Is that correct?
Absolutely. Okay. Specific changes to the non-formula portion of our budget are more numerous, but have less monetary significance than the program formula programs. Highlights in this area include small increases to the jobs program, medical assistance claims processing, post-mortem examinations, and a vacancy and turnover rate reduction for social workers. Increases have also been requested to deal with violent juvenile offenders at the youth correctional facilities, reopening of a wing at Harborview Developmental Center, and annualization of the developmental disabilities grant component needed for residents discharged from Harborview during fiscal year 94. The department has also recommended a major shift in the funding for Alaska Psychiatric Institute. With the inclusion of the $7 million in Medicaid disproportionate share funds in API's budget, funds were able to be reallocated from API to community mental health programs, and a decrement of $1.5 million resulted. In summary, the non-formula side of our budget has an overall reduction of $624.7 thousand. You had asked for some specific information about positions within the department. Overall, our department is requesting 44 new permanent full-time and part-time positions. 10 of these are 100% federally funded. 8 are in public assistance data processing and the jobs program. 1 is for McLaughlin Youth Center, and 1 is for Medicaid claims processing. 5 are for implementation of the medical examiner system within the post-mortem program. 8 are in mental health and API, and 11 are for reopening a wing at Harborview Developmental Center. During FY94, the department laid off one person. We have not yet evaluated the expected savings from the hiring freeze, but many of the employees in our department who deal directly with the public, including public health nurses, social workers, and others, are exempt from the freeze, as well as all of our institutions' staff who have direct 24-hour contact.
Could you give me a Xerox copy of your report?
Sure. Glad to.
That it opens a lot of quick avenues to move in and
certainly budget. Get that to you right away.
Thank you.
And we have our overview, so we are here for.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
One question that. It seemed like it would be possible to reduce some funding. I thought I read that, or support, reduce support in, for some senior medical programs. But I didn't hear any potential or any possibility of this side of actual legislation, at least, to make reductions anyplace else in the support system for welfare needs and so on. Nothing that looked like you could fix within the system if you were trying to reduce budget. I'm not suggesting that I'm trying to at this moment either, but I didn't hear any place else that readily, sitting here without massive changes, we could do anything about. Is that about right?
Maybe we could look closer at the drug prescriptions. I noted the article in the paper last week of that guy that was, I think he was charged with murder, and he'd been prescribed for him some 4,000 pills over the last some period. I was a little shocked, obviously. I'm sure most people in the state were shocked that the Medicaid was paying for that, and that a physician operating within this state was still operating under that program and was still eligible to prescribe Medicaid drugs. I found it kind of outrageous, and I'm sure most people in Alaska did. I would like
the licensing board to get interested.
I think so.
Mr. Chairman, it bothers me, though, that the only place we can do whack or move into or reduce are just senior programs. Some of those are most eligible by virtue of residency and then the most need. And some of the others, I mean, you get reports, the person running our food service contribution system in the valley, a very distinguished man, retired minister who spent years and years of his life in this. It is my opinion that he told me the following story. I don't swear it was he, but he said there's people on a continuous basis that have been sent up here, been advised in California and in Florida, places where they're tightening up. Well, go to Alaska. Between the permanent fund and the added welfare benefits, you do quite well up there. And he says he sees them all the time, not just occasional. And of course, you know, we expanded from, 40 to 50,000 people in the Matanuska Valley in the last couple of years, and from 6 to 40 previously. An awful lot of these people are in problems. They've come from someplace. I don't think they all come from downtown Anchorage or Fairbanks, for that matter, because you haven't lost any. So it worries me that we should provide attraction. I want to help our own.
This is a good question. I don't know where we are. We've talked about this in-migration or this magnet effect. I don't know that. I don't know if there's a report that's been prepared.
If we could have Jan Hansen come up, she could tell you some things about the newer arrivals and what that data
is. Do you have a report on that, Jan?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we do.
Our food bank system has been, he watches it. Very good person.
I can provide to the committee the data that we've pulled together, which we'll give, but briefly, we have studied, when people apply for assistance, they indicate whether they have been in the state for less than a year, and so we then track. And what we have found is that for applicants for the AFDC program, about 20% of the applicants have been in the state for less than a year. But I want to be clear that that doesn't mean that they just came up here. We then survey every AFDC applicant who tells us that they've been here for 1 year or less when they applied, and we ask them, why did you come? And we found in our survey in the last year that they give the primary answers of they used to live here, they have family and friends here, they were looking for work here. We had one or two responses that indicated that they knew of the benefit, the AFDC benefit level. We get more people who knew of what they called benefits in Alaska, such as the permanent fund that was available to them. But they did not say that they were coming for the benefit. In terms of the percentage of people that are here...
But they're smart, and you wouldn't expect them to say that, would you?
No, I wouldn't.
You have to wonder about that 1 or 2% that did. They're either truthful or...
But I'd like to put it in perspective overall. Of everyone who is on AFDC now, there are 8% of the caseload have been in Alaska for less than 1 year. We did a figure in 1985, and in 1985, 6% of the caseload had been in the state for less than a year. I think those put the figures into perspective, that though the percentage of applications in a given month is a higher percent, that 20% of the people applying have been here. The percentage of people who have been here just 1 to 3 months is something like 6% of the applicants. And there is a higher percentage of what we call recent arrivals to the state applying for adult public assistance than for AFDC. So if we look at the two programs, there is a higher percentage for the adult public assistance program than for AFDC that are new to more recent to the state. I don't have the other figures in front of me, but I'd be happy to furnish the findings.
Would you please do that? Is there any? This is just they tell you kind of thing. It isn't any. You don't have really any way of knowing whether they're filling out the forms truthfully or not, I guess, do you?
Mr. Chairman, no, we don't. We have done two different kinds of surveys. Granted, the survey I just referenced is actually done in the office, handed out to people. We did another survey the previous year that was part of our self-sufficiency report where we had, that was published in the Trends article, and that one was a survey that went out to the clients by mail. Again, it was done by the division, but it wasn't done right in the offices, and we surveyed people as to why they came, and we found essentially the same data from both studies that we've done. And I would also say that this data seems to be replicated in other states that have done what they call migration studies.
So if it isn't some magnet from outside, and it isn't, I mean, our unemployment rate, I think, has been... low from historical standards. What explains the large increase from year to year? You're talking...
Mr. Chairman, there's a number of things, no one of which explains it. Certainly... a piece of it is that the population of Alaska has grown. That certainly doesn't explain the whole growth, but that takes care of a couple of percentages. There are new people coming into the state who, though they, and I don't mean to say that there aren't people coming to the state who then go on assistance, but they come to the state because they want to get a job. Alaska is still seen for some as a better place to live than where they were before. There's serious unemployment and economic problems in a number of states, and people are moving from those states because they see there's a better economic climate here. They come in, they apply for unemployment, they end up on welfare. So there are people coming from outside that contribute to that figure. Another piece of it, the high caseload growth, was the addition of the unemployed parent, the two-parent program that we were required to add in 1990. A third piece is, in fact, the economy. I'll use, for example, Sitka, where the pulp mill shut down. Now, we don't have the people who are working at the mill coming in, but we have certainly seen an increase in our Sitka caseload, because when there's an economic disruption like that in a community, some of the part-time help at the local grocery store and gas station, those are the people that are let go as they see the economy, and those are the people that are marginally employed and then fall into the welfare ranks. So we do have people that were unemployed.
Was there another question? Senator Sharp, or Senator Rieger, and then Senator Sharp.
It's not on the AFTC, but on Medicaid. What kind of case management system do you have in place for someone like the case Senator Frank described? Can a person still just go in and ask for a service without some kind of oversight? I don't know how to ask the question most precisely, but I'm trying to figure out if there is some kind of administrative management of a person who perhaps is over-consuming or consuming the wrong services.
Mr. Chairman, for people who are getting prescriptions, there are two types of oversight immediately, and one is for people who are aberrant, who have an aberrant utilization pattern, or an aberrant prescription pattern, we can put these people into lock-in, what we call sort of a managed, it's a managed system where they pick one physician, one pharmacist, and one dentist. People who are abusing drugs, for example, go to many different pharmacists, many different physicians, and dentists as well to get those prescriptions. So we lock them in for at least a year, and we see a marked reduction in utilization for those people. And I have figures on that, and I can give you the cost savings and cost avoidance, if you will, that we have experienced with those people, their behavior before and their behavior after. And we get data to identify those people in many different ways. We ask providers to identify them to us. We also get data from our claims payment system, where we see these aberrant utilization patterns. The other thing we have in place is drug utilization review, which is done at the pharmacist level and is counseling and observation of what prescriptions the person is getting and how they interact with each other. What we hope to go to is an online ProDRS drug utilization review, which would be prospective drug utilization review, where online the pharmacist would have data about all the prescriptions paid for by Medicaid at the time they fill that prescription. And that's been real successful in states, again, reducing. One of the things that really helps is, especially for elderly people it's really harmful, of course, to get drugs that interact badly with each other, and people end up in a higher level of care often as a result. There are good studies that show that. And so it helps those people, and it also helps this small group who are abusing.
And beyond drugs and prescription drugs, do you have, I think I read about some states that have this, have you considered having a kind of a gatekeeper system where you must go to a primary care provider first and then be referred, say, to go to the hospital or wherever? Isn't that used in some states for the Medicaid system?
And we don't have, and it's really, we haven't looked at it as real practical, except maybe in the Anchorage area because of lack of providers. But what we do have is we do have some gatekeeping functions for certain kinds of services. Hospitalizations, for example, have to go through a prior authorization. Non-emergency travel has to go through a prior authorization process. Continued length of stay in a hospital beyond the 50th percentile has to go through an additional review process. every inpatient psychiatric hospitalization, whether it's in a general hospital or a psychiatric hospital, has to go through a review to approve that admission. We pick certain procedures, particularly certain surgical procedures that can be more commonly abused, and those have to go through an additional review after the person's actually had the service. We have additional review processes that we go through to look at modifiers on claims, for example. Just one position in my Anchorage office last year saved by denying claims for modifiers on CPT-4 codes over $1 million. That was just one position, and that was just part of this job. So we do a lot of reviews on claims, and we do a lot of cost savings.
Last question, Mr. Chairman. On the optional services, whatever, you know, you have the mandatory list and then the additional, I'm not sure optional is the right word for that, but you have the statutory authority to charge co-payments on options, or does everything have to be 100% paid?
You do have, Mr. Chairman, you do have, Senator Rieger, you do have the option of charging a co-pay. Unfortunately, federal law prevents that from being a very meaningful copay. You can't charge it against many classes of clients. You can't, and that may be, and that's a matter of judgment whether that's fortunate or unfortunate. The types of clients you can't charge it against are people like pregnant women. Perhaps one wouldn't want to dissuade them from getting services, or children and some disabled groups. The state can charge copays, but only in extremely nominal amounts. It's like 50 cents or a dollar. What happens, how that works in our claims payment system, is we deduct that from the rate that we would pay for the provider. The provider is on the hook to identify that that person is in a class they can collect the copay from, and they can do that by looking at the person's coupon or getting it from our online EBS system that they can get hooked up to by telephone. And then they have to charge it from the person there while they're in the pharmacy. Pharmacy would be a really common example. We used to do that in pharmacy claims, in fact, but the pharmacists liked it. They did not like it when we would have had to go to identifying certain groups of clients, because they said that would be too onerous administratively.
And I said the last one was my last question, but just to follow up on that, is this something that is eligible for applying for a waiver in order to be able to do?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rieger, members of the committee, no. We've tried.
Say that again. You've tried what?
We petitioned the federal government some years ago to give us more latitude on the copay, and they refused. It's in the law, and I don't think they really have the latitude to waive it.
Can you give us a report on that, including the federal laws that, you know, limit you on that?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Sharp.
Back to the one-year residency thing. If someone comes up here and is on unemployment, that unemployment counts towards their income level, doesn't it, before they can qualify for...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharp, that's my understanding, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Any income counts against any public assistance that they're going to qualify for.
So if someone comes up and actually was on, could be a non-productive citizen for the whole year and
not show up in the 1 year,
it came up, you know, a lot of them do go on unemployment to begin with, and then when that runs out, they switch over to welfare. So,
Mr. Chairman, that is a possible scenario. Their unemployment would be higher than the welfare amount. They wouldn't get welfare. When the unemployment ran out, they could possibly qualify for welfare.
Since the increases are basically hung on the client-driven situation, increase in budget, what happens as far as the federal mandates when there's just not enough nickels in the pot after 9 months and no one gets paid? What's the feds do then? I mean, you can only be client-driven up to a certain point when you run out of money. Then what do you do? just adding $40 million every year, you know, is not the answer, obviously. You can't cut that much out of the rest of the budget. So when you run out of money, you run out of money. I don't care what the federal mandate is. But that's a possibility that we're going to have to look at.
We run everybody out rather than the abusers. So that's
And I don't know what the priorities are within the department or the federal guidelines. Who would, under that scenario, who would be serviced first? Or if everybody gets full payment until the day that the bank account goes dry and then everybody suffers, or if there's a priority on aid to dependent children first, or if that's a whole different program.
Mr. Chairman, if I can respond briefly to that on kind of what the impact is if there was not enough money in a given year. We have to pay out to people the amount that in statute is our payment standard. So within the department, we would not have the leeway if it looked like there wasn't enough money for the whole year. We don't have the leeway to reduce that money to make it last the whole year, because we have to pay out to all qualifying individuals the amount that is in statute. So as a department, we would have to continue to pay out until we ran out.
Okay, so you can't selectively prioritize aid to dependent children over Medicaid or families with two adults in the qualifying in the federal program. You can't selectively eliminate those type of
unemployed parents?
No, I cannot eliminate any group within that would qualify. We have to operate it within the confines of the federal law and our state.
So
I don't have a choice to say we don't have enough money this year, so we won't give AFDC to two-parent families, because that's a requirement. And I also don't have a choice to say we will pay them less.
It's either all or nothing, then.
The standard is all or nothing until the money is spent.
Isn't the increase in client load, previous testimony, I think last year, from about 1989 or 90, caused by the new federal program for broadening the type of families that can qualify?
That is a big piece of the caseload growth. In 1990, when we had to add the two-parent families, that's added significantly. If I can place it in perspective as to where our growth is with the rest of the nation in terms of the previous debate, we have high growth because we also added the unemployed parent in 1990, and all of those 20 states that didn't have unemployed parent have had tremendous growth. So we went and we looked at, if we analyzed as though we had already had the unemployed parent program back there, where does Alaska's AFDC growth fall in the rest of the nation? And we fall right between Oregon and Idaho, some other western states, and our growth then would have been about 20th in the nation. So we're about half midway of the kind of growth we've had in the AFDC program compared to other states have had in their AFDC programs over the same time period.
Is that a program that is optional by state?
Mr. Chairman, the AFDC program is optional. It has tremendous fiscal impacts because it's tied to other programs. Participating in AFDC is tied to Medicaid. Without AFDC, you can't get Medicaid. And it's also tied to the foster care, part of the foster care payments, and the welfare to work jobs program.
But that's aid to families with dependent children.
Families with dependent children.
But what about unemployed parents? Primarily, this is two adult parents.
The two-parent unemployed family is part. The aid to families with dependent children serves two kinds of families. They serve what we call basic, which are one-parent, and two-parent, in which they are unemployed.
Not dividable.
We must do both. Ever since 1990, we have no choice but to serve both categories.
Senator Kutuzov.
One quick question before I have my main one. There's nothing in Alaska statutes that can be done to reduce the potential for real abuse in these areas, say adult public assistance. We're so tied to federal statutes.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I would ask for clarification in terms of...
Well, we spoke to some of them overall, but here I'll cite one. Because I think something, we need the principal committee of the legislature, just say HESS, subcommittees of the Senate, something, to gain knowledge from you on how to write law that may plug some loopholes that Americans are always glad to fit into. My question is, as I have no knowledge of the following, but this is a very typical example. A man with five children living in a fairly good trailer house, good pickup truck, three-wheeler or four-wheeler to hunt with, plenty of guns. He is on adult public assistance, or AFDC, as he and his wife, is offered low-paying jobs throughout the summer, tells the people that offer him that they don't want to offer him work. It would be a big, big mistake if they offered him work. And they think about it a while, and you know, barns can burn down and other things, and they don't hire him. Now, that takes a report. They're not about to report. They're agitated because he won't work. On the other hand, he doesn't make, they don't pay enough for him to. But this whole thing bothers me a great deal because he's perfectly capable of contributing to society. He just chose not to, and he fits a niche. Now, you can tell me, of course, if he was reported, problem, but how can we do what we can at this level to prevent it from happening to begin with? That's just one example. Is there something that, for instance, the Hess Committee could look into and come back to finance with a suggested amendment to the existing law that would really plug that type of loophole out? I don't know. I haven't gotten too devious with that example, but in fact, it's a true example so far as I know.
Mr. Chairman, let me respond. If it is a true example, I'd like to know who it is, because it's very likely this person doesn't qualify. The fact that you mentioned that they have a fairly expensive vehicle. To qualify for the AFDC program, there is a...
$3,000 or something.
There's a vehicle limitation. You can have $1,500 worth of vehicle if your value is more than that, it applies against it. The loophole there is that an individual can transfer title of their vehicle to someone outside of the unit. I don't know how to plug that loophole. But if they do have an expensive vehicle, they don't qualify. In fact, we turn down half of the people that apply for aid to families with dependent children are turned down every month. We get 1,400 applications a month, and we turn down close to half of those every month, many because they do own vehicles that are more than the limit that you can have on welfare. But I want to move on because there's an answer to Senator Curtula's question. That individual, the way we can't right now under the AFDC program as written, we can't require that person to go take that job. We don't know that it's there. But what we can and will do comes under our jobs program. Within the jobs program for the two-parent family in particular, we have a requirement that they have to come into the jobs program and they either get a job that pays money, they go find a job that pays money, or they have to do community service work. They have to do the public service work for at least 16 to 20 hours a week.
What about school?
If they are in school, they don't have to do the work. So that would exempt them from, if they're in certain kinds, if they're a young parent in school. But if we're talking about someone over 24 who's unemployed, we now have a mechanism for requiring that person to either get a job or if they are not in paid work, to do unpaid work. That program is being geared up now, will be expanded next year in the jobs program.
Will they be able to go to trade school type things? Qualify. Get them out of that, those that wish to.
Chairman, there's a high...
A lot of women wish to. I don't know about the indolent males. But.
I'm making a slight distinction here between the way the requirement of the family headed by a single woman and the two-parent family.
Yeah, but this two-parent family involves a woman.
And in the two-parent family, we have got to put 50% of those people into work experience, which means we cannot have them in job training. We have to put 16 to 20 hours a week into work experience.
I would think that you could require them to go to a job course, something the same way as you require work experience to get out of this. Someone would get training and be on their way to doing something, but I'll quit it. I sort of understand it. It's frustrated me and frustrated many of us for many, many years. The abuses are the problem. I mean, if there are abuses, those are the ones you want to plug up so that people just, Americans tend to abuse programs when they see an opportunity. And I don't want to deny kids and people that are taking care of kids, you know, a decent food on the table and so on. That isn't what I want to do at all. But I sure want to stop those people that are are abusing our programs, and that hurts. And the newly arrivals worry me, too, if other states are pointing in this direction, as has been indicated by the person that I was just talking about, who seems to have a lot of them come in every day or every week. Thank you. Thank you. I don't know how we get on top of it. This is an every-year exercise rather than any real accomplishment.
I had a couple questions. Jan, you said that program AFDC was optional. What is it called? Two-parent program? What's that?
The unemployed parent.
Unemployed parent.
Is a part of
is that, that is that optional?
No longer. Mr. Chairman, when it was optional, we did not have it. When it became mandatory, we had to add it.
Right. Okay, so the only option we have is to participate in AFDC or not. We can't get rid of the two-parent thing, right?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
If we have AFDC generally, we have to have that option, or we have to have that part of the program.
Yes.
What was the logic? I never have quite understood that. Providing benefits to a family that had two able-bodied parents.
Mr. Chairman, I think to summarize most briefly, it was to have equity that if individuals were poor and if children were living in poor families, that they should be provided basic food, shelter, and that the same benefits should be provided to the children whether they were in a family with one parent or with two parents if there was no income. And so it was that you would look at the income level. And we need to take it from the perspective, the federal legislation for AFDC is intended to provide benefits for children. So much of the debate now, of course, focuses on parents who may or may not be willing to do things society wants them to do. But the program was designed to meet the needs of the children via a payment to the parents. And so it created an equity between kids in with one parent and kids with two parents, that if neither parent was working over here, they both were going to get that basic welfare income level. If I could respond also to add kind of to the gist of some of the questions that have come in as to what can be done in terms of changing the program, just mention that there is national reform afoot, and there are proposals in the National Congress. President Clinton has indicated that he will provide a proposal to the Congress this spring. And in those proposals, all of them do things that address some of the concerns I'm hearing from this committee, and certainly some of the concerns we have, to create a program that does not allow abuse, supports the kind of values of people working, of people taking responsibility for themselves, and of people being accountable, while at the same time still meeting the needs of poor people. The concept of time-limited benefits, so that an individual would be given perhaps 2 years to train and learn and either find a job, and if they didn't find a job, that they would have to give something back. So we're in the context of either national welfare reform. The other is that there's a possibility to do a demonstration project within the various states. And so though we can't decide not to do two-parent families, there are demonstration projects that can be done. We have studied those. I'd be happy to provide information to the committee. There's a lot of downsides. We can't make a change to the whole state program via a demonstration. A demonstration has to be to a specific part, perhaps to Anchorage or to half of Anchorage or to Anchorage, Matsu, and comparing it, or do it in Fairbanks and compare it to Kenai. And in fact, a number of legislators have asked us for information, and we've been furnishing that to people on what could be done in terms of a demonstration waiver project and what's happening on the federal level.
Well, I guess I'm a tad skeptical about welfare reform because 1988 or whenever they added the two-parent situation, that was billed as reform, and we saw our, you know, caseload go way up and our costs go way up. And then I also heard somebody on TV a few weeks or months ago that was talking about welfare reform and said, I don't know if the Congress will support the additional money that's required for welfare reform. Boy, if that's what reform is, forget it. We see a budget growth in this area that is so far outpacing every other area of the budget. We've got a HES budget that's, as the commissioner outlines, is being dominated now by the formula programs, and And we've got a, you know, people have talked about an income tax, and I don't know how much it's going to raise, if we ever had one, but it would be somewhere between $200 and $300 million probably. We've got a HES budget that we can't even support, you know, if we dedicated an entire income tax to it. And I suspect that if you just looked at AFDC and Medicaid, those two programs alone would gobble up an entire state income tax. And if the people of Alaska understood that this program, these programs are taking up the entire amount that would be generated by a state income tax, I think they'd be, rightfully so, I think they'd be darn concerned. I think we've got to be very serious about how we contain growth, how we make this program provide benefits to those people that really need it, and not just consume our whole budget. And it, I'm just talking about the problem, not talking about solutions. But
up to our initiative, though. We write the law.
Very much up to our initiative. And I would like to work with the department very seriously, with Senator Katula, that's expressed concern on this, to try to do something about it, because if we don't, I just don't see the future looks pretty grim.
Let us have one meeting at least and check with the agency. I'd like to, my experience is, Mr. Chairman, is if you get the knowledge from the people working with it, sometimes you can put something together. I don't have enough knowledge really to ask questions, hardly. But they have to have the knowledge.
Senator Sharp. Thanks. Is there any allowance under the federal mandates, especially on two-parent families that qualify, so-called job-oriented training, get them off of the rolls because of jobs that forces them to enroll with the employment service, and any job they turn down is deducted from their benefit? I mean, somewhere along the line, you've got to make the turn down of work penalize and work against the amount they receive, because it's a voluntary choice not to work if there is work available. And I think a mandatory requirement that they sign up with the employment service is something that would be key to meaningful reform anyway. And if they don't take it, the employment service usually has an estimate of what the job would have paid. They take a reduction. I can't imagine people refuse to work, especially in a two-parent situation.
They lose their medical. They get $6, yeah. $8 an hour, and they lose their medical, you see. And that's the reason a lot of pretty good people won't work. That's one of the factors. I know that to be true. Whole thing takes some real effort.
Yeah, but there's a lot of choices that you've got to make in everyday life, what you got to do without.
But suppose
if
you're as worried as I am about the medical aspect and you're getting it under welfare, then you could make about what you're getting in welfare going to work, say McDonald's type jobs and stuff. You might even go to work if you could just even it, but the medical is the big thing. One of these people, I've talked to some of them.
Might be a way to split that
off. If they could get their medical, neither job, they'd probably work for the same amount they're getting in welfare, the better one.
I think there's some pilot projects in the states that allow that medical.
That might be a pilot project.
A meeting I think would be a good idea.
I'd rather put them to work
at
even dollars, but that's the problem. If they can't get that fringe, they won't go out to work.
Well, that may be a valid point, but on the other hand, I just heard on APRN this morning, a guy that was working but didn't have insurance, talking about the whole health care insurance problem. And he said he didn't have it because it just wasn't that high up on his priority list.
You're younger.
And I think there are people that, aren't necessarily persuaded or aren't induced to be on welfare solely for insurance benefits.
There are.
There may be some like that. But
I think under 40 you might not be.
Yeah, I think so. I think younger people are generally not as concerned. If you're not got kids, you probably are more concerned, obviously. But anyway, we need to work.
Chairman, if I can respond to that, also in our study, we did ask the welfare recipients. And one of the issues, a lot of young people, of course, are not interested in medical care. But you just hit in your final comment on the reason that such a high percentage of people on welfare are, because because you can only qualify for aid to families with dependent children if you have minor children in the family. And so there's probably a higher percentage of the people on welfare who care about it than single individuals that don't have dependents.
Okay. Yeah, any other questions on that? I feel like we've probably unfairly focused all of our attention on this area, the budget of your budget. It's, you know, we look at the macro situation and we've got four or five programs that are growing much faster than our ability to fund them. And you know, two or three of them are in your budget and
up 30%.
So it tends to heighten our focus on those. So it doesn't mean that we're not interested in the rest of your budget. But I'm not sure that we've got specific questions here today. I don't have any more at this point. I don't know if other members have questions.
Just one question to you. What happens if we don't fund this by, say, $50 million, period? Don't say no supplemental. What happens?
Well, obviously, if we don't do, if they run out of money at the end of the fiscal year, then I think, to be practical, the governor's got some real hard decisions to make. The governor probably, I'm guessing, but the governor probably either A, pays them anyway and lets the court decide whether that was a legal payment if anybody challenges, or he comes down here and you know, arm wrestles us for the money. I'm guessing, I'm speculating, but that's the effect. I suspect that the checks would go out still somehow.
I do too. Or maybe 70 or 80 will move into your camper park. There's one place. Just thinking about turning
it here, I doubt it.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to add, I'm Janet Clark from the department, that our department has also recognized that if you're going to control health and social services overall budget, we do have to look at the formula programs, and that's why our presentation focus. The rest of our budget can't absorb these kinds of increases either because it's a very stable kind of growth. So we think it's important to give you all the information that you would need.
Reduced formulas?
There are mechanisms in law to reduce formulas. Last year you passed the rateable reduction, and that's available for AFDC. In the Medicaid program, it's the list that's in statute in AS 47 that we mentioned already. The governor's office, the governor is supportive of those programs that are in statute, and that's why the budget request is full funding for those programs. But obviously the legislature can take a look at those services that are on that list as well. And we also have other ideas that we could talk to you about as far as alternatives for cost containment in Medicaid that we've shared with subcommittees in the past, and we'd be glad to give you all that kind of information at that level.
I don't know. It's unfortunately, I'm putting time in this, but rumor has it that, say, the state of Florida pays quite a bit less people than Alaska does in these varying categories. So does that mean the state of Florida has law on the books that says so much will go for AFDC per person or whatever, or so much will go adult public assistance, which more interests me as an abuse potential, and that we have a different law on our books that allows for more?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
That means there is no federal direction. It's our own direction in this regard.
That's correct.
We could reduce those, is what you're telling me.
Yes, you could.
Thank you for giving me the ABCs.
Okay, other questions for the department? Okay, thank you very much. Look forward to working.
Feel free to contact us. We have a lot of knowledge and a lot of people that worked in this for a long while. Ready to give you information.
Okay, thank you.
I'm real worried that we don't concentrate on the elderly and senior Alaskans as a method of reduction. I'd like to concentrate, if possible, on those that can work, should be able to work, and so on.
That's
at a greater.
It's an option for the.
Yeah,
that's what maybe, I think most of.
Maybe everybody comes into it, but the easy one may be the seniors. That's the problem I see here.
It's always been so easy in the past, hasn't it?
We'll take a 3-minute recess. Commissioner Campbell, would you like to join us and bring whoever you'd like to? Just before we get started, for the benefit of the committee, we are going to hearing on the capital budget, on the DOT's capital budget next Wednesday, I believe it is. So if you would please withhold questions on the capital budget until Wednesday and focus today's efforts on the operating budget, I think that will help us complete our work in a timely manner this morning. So, Commissioner, if you'd like to go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to take this opportunity to introduce the new Deputy Commissioner of Transportation, Helvi Sandvik, to the members of the committee. I'm sure you'll be seeing quite a bit of Helvi. I'm going to rely on her quite heavily to do quite a bit of work with the legislature this year. Also, I think most of you remember and know Ron Lind, our administrative director on my right. Mr. Chairman, as far as the DOT operating budget is concerned, we have a nominal increase of about $6 million out of general fund, $6.3 million. If you will look down the scoop sheet that we sent to you here, I think you'll see that the two big factors on that are, one, the raise in the equipment rental rate to keep our working capital fund balanced, and the second, of course, is the cost of new facilities, which is new airports, new highways, and these kinds of things. Those are the two big increases that we have. The rest of the increases are primarily things that we can't control. Facilities maintenance, for instance, down there, the biggest fixed cost increase we've got there is the increase of utility costs, is primarily electricity. They added the Juneau Court Plaza building to our budget, which, of course, also upgrades our costs there. The central region and the facilities maintenance area, of course, we've got buildings there with much deferred maintenance that needs increased attention. As far as the design and construction area goes, the ICE-T program that we have, our capital budget, has required us to put more money out in rural areas, which means we've got increased administration costs because, too, we'll have more travel and administration to more remote areas, and we will have a greater number of projects. Administration and leasing, this is primarily a revenue generator where we will be increasing the cost of people to do a better job of leasing airport space, and this, of course, will probably generate revenue. Marine transportation system is essentially a wash. The only increased cost we'll have there will show up in a capital budget, which will be for the dry dock facilities in Ketchikan. We see this pretty much as a hold-the-line budget, not much increase of any percent, a high percentage in any area. I think that's just the overall that we've got to give you, and certainly any questions we'll try to answer.
Okay. I just would like to welcome Senator Little to the table. She does serve on the subcommittee. I had just one question, but I'll defer. Senator Couture, go ahead.
Mine is just, do you have sufficient maintenance funds in your budget to cover, from your experiences, the necessary maintenance? That's always an area of great concern to me and to all of us. At times we have shorted maintenance, and even right down to the free conference committee, we've had fights. The Senate is usually held for a good maintenance budget, and the House sometimes had other priorities. And again, if you propose sufficient maintenance this year from predictable, I mean, obviously there's weather problems can come up.
One of the things that we've did, Senator Kutula, that I didn't mention here is we are going to ask for our maintenance funds in one appropriation rather than for regions. The reason for this is this will allow us a lot more flexibility to work between regions and cover problems that we're not covering now. I think, as you realize, that probably 90% of our budget is weather-driven. So while we may have an easy time in one area of the state, we may have a tough time in the other area of the state. By allowing us more flexibility, we can, I think, do a much more efficient job and be a lot more reactive. What we've already done since I've been on board here is we are switching equipment and people back and forth between regions as the need arises. Yes. This has worked very well. The problem is, of course, we have to account for it in the region that their budget is in, and this becomes accounting disadvantage to us. But what we will be looking for is more flexibility and just having one maintenance fund so that we can react better to weather and conditions. And in answer, direct answer to your question, yes, I think that this fund is adequate. We've increased the Dalton a little bit. We've increased facilities maintenance in Anchorage a little bit. But by and large, it's a hold-the-line budget. And I think we can do a good job for you.
We'll get into the capital needs then in the next part of the budget. This always worried me about one can sit on good facilities and good equipment, and the next area not have it.
Well, you'll notice that one thing that we've got in here is about $1.2 million that we've got in the cost of new and expanded facilities. That's for the new airports we've got, the new, in your area, of course, the new fair lane, four lane out to Palmer, which increases our lane miles. And that picks up the additional, that puts maintenance on the additional capital expenditures.
Senator Sharp, Mr. Chairman, and I have finally come to a conclusion on how to avoid the impact of Matt Sue that's been coming with the four lane and others, the extra 10,000 we arrived at in the last couple of years. We're going to have four lanes to Fairbanks with no off ramps.
Hey, as long as they're all tourists, that's fine with me. Senator Little.
Commissioner, what is the status of the new ferry that was talked about a lot last session?
That's in the capital budget, and that is, as far as we know at this point, is proceeding. It's on schedule.
Commissioner, perhaps you're unable to answer this, but I see Tracy back there in the audience trying to hide, and so I was wondering if she could perhaps enlighten us as to whether or not there is an attendant $200,000 reduction in the Department of Administration leasing section that would coincide with this $200,000 increase that you're being forced to absorb for the Court Plaza. The whole idea of putting this Court Plaza on the state's books was to save money, and I'm just wondering if there was a $200,000 reduction in Department of Administration, or whether OMB required the Department of Administration to absorb a $200,000 reduction to offset this $200,000 increase.
Mr. Chairman, the Department of Administration is currently reviewing their leasing budget for fiscal year 95. At this point, they are not reducing their budget by the $200,000.
Was there a reason for that?
Well, you'd probably have to talk to the Department of Administration specifically, but it's my understanding that with all their other leases coming due, they do not have the flexibility within their budget to make room for this $200,000.
Okay. I'm not surprised. Thanks for the answer, though. Okay. The fixed cost increases that you have there under facilities, what are the nature of the fixed cost increases?
Who wants to take that?
You've got them both in highways and aviation, M&O, and the facilities maintenance, 590 under facilities management and 177.
I'll cover some of that. One of the areas is the elimination of the power cost equalization program as it applies to the state, and that particularly hits us in the Western District up out of Nome. That amounts to about $73,700. Risk management increases on our costs in the western area of the state, northern western area of the state. It is also, we had to go out for a contract to move our people who deal with the Dalton High